Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. I'll remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. Remember, it is a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. You can also check it out at steinershow.org and click on their banner. All the information will be right there. We are joined this evening for this hour, in the 5 o'clock hour, by Greg Bernstein, of course, our Baltimore City State's Attorney. There we go. My headphones were soft a little bit. He's here, and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be here.
Number here is 410-319-8888. As I half-jokingly said at the top of the hour, you always talk about Greg Bernstein. Now you can talk with Greg Bernstein and raise the issues with him on the air here now. 410-319-8888 is the number, and we'll get to your calls here in just a few minutes as they come in. So I guess the broad question first, similarly a softball, they say, before we get into hardball a little bit, is you've been here, it's been a year.
It's been a year.
So how do you assess yourself?
Well, it's been a very interesting year, but, you know, also, Mark, it's been extremely productive. We've already instituted a number of new programs and initiatives that make our office much more effective, efficient, strategic. I don't really know where to begin. There's been so much, but we started our major investigations unit about 6 months ago. We launched that where we recruited a terrific young guy from the U.S. Attorney's Office to come run that. The purpose of that unit is to focus on the repeat violent offenders. You know, Mark, all the data shows that most of the violent crime in the city is committed by a relatively few, disproportionately few number of people. So if we can be strategic in terms of gathering intelligence, working with our law enforcement partners, both on the local and federal level, to build cases against these individuals, we're going to have a measurable impact on the violent crime in this city. As I mentioned, we got a terrific young guy to run that. We took some of our top prosecutors, put them in the unit, and they're using proactive techniques, building cases as opposed to just doing reactive type work, which, again, I think, given the level of participation those individuals have in the violent crime in the city, is going to have a real impact. Last week, we launched our community prosecution model. You may have heard something about that.
I read about it.
And, you know, this is really a sea change in the way that the office operates. You know, your listeners and the public, you know, generally think of prosecutors' offices as having the traditional felony unit, misdemeanor unit, narcotics unit. We have a special firearms unit. Well, we've dismantled all those units because I think that my prosecutors have tended to focus on cases rather than defendants and not really understanding the impact of the case on the particular defendant and, more importantly, the impact on the community in which the crime occurred. And most crime is local in the sense that the people who commit criminal offenses generally stay in the same geographic area. So what we did after a lot of work, it took us about 6 months to put it together, is we've divided the city into three zones that match three each of the nine police districts. The city's divided into nine districts. Zone one consists of the Eastern, Northeastern, and Southeastern police districts. Zone 2 is the Western, Central, and Southern police districts, or the area covered by those districts.
Right.
And Zone 3 is the Southwest, Northern, and Northwestern police districts. We have a lot of strategic reasons why we did that in terms of where crime's occurring and the like. And then I took my prosecutors and said, all right, you're no longer a narcotics prosecutor. You're no longer a general felony prosecutor. Now you're a Zone 1 prosecutor or a Zone 2 prosecutor. And you're responsible, along with your other colleagues in that zone, to prosecute all the crime that's occurring within that area, within your zone. Now, this does two things, we think. First, it will allow us to be forging much closer relationships with our law enforcement partners because the police department is divided up in these precincts. So no longer will you have, say, a narcotics prosecutor who on Monday has a case from the Western District with a narcotics detective, and then on Wednesday another case with a narcotics detective from the Eastern District, and then maybe never get another case with them again in a couple of years. Now you're going to be working with the same detectives, the same officers on a regular basis, forging better relationships, and I think making for much more effective prosecutions. Second, it allows the prosecutors to become much more connected to the communities that they serve and the communities where the crime is occurring, because now they'll have a much better understanding because they'll be doing it on a more regular basis, focusing on those same communities. They'll have a much better understanding of how a particular case is impacting on the community, what the relationship is between this defendant and maybe another defendant. And lastly, and maybe even more importantly, it allows the prosecutors within the zone to work together, kind of sharing information, understanding the relationship. So, for example, take the Pennsylvania Avenue corridor where you've got a lot of drug dealing. So let's say that the police make an arrest of someone selling drugs to someone on a street corner. So what used to happen is the buyer is charged with possession and he or she goes to district court. The seller, the dealer, gets charged with a felony and he goes up to circuit court. Maybe there's a lookout 50 feet away who has a gun and he's a prohibited person. In other words, he's not allowed to have a gun. So that case goes to the firearms unit or our 5 unit for prosecution. Let's say that the dealer's crew is in some spat with a rival drug crew and they get into a fight and gunshots are exchanged. Nobody gets hit. So that goes to the general felony section. And then maybe 2 weeks later, the dealer gets shot and that goes off to the 5 unit. So what happens is you've got all these different divisions, all these different units, prosecutors working on a case that really has are all connected. Well, now under the community prosecution model, that's going to stay within the same zone, same prosecutors, and I think will be much more effective.
Now, before you open the phones here, 410-319-8888, and we'll come to Clarence and Darren, the first two callers, up in just a minute. When you talked about this, the first unit you said you are creating in the department that brought the former USDA in, we had David Kennedy on the show not long ago. Clearly has a different model for how you might prosecute and go after the most violent offenders and how you involve the community in that process.
I'm not sure I'd agree with your premise. I think you said he has a very different model. I'm not so sure I agree with that.
Why is it not different?
Well, because I think that the David Kennedy model is based on this same kind of focused attention on the people who are committing most of the violent crime. I think if you asked him, he would say that what we're doing is very much in line with the kind of programs that he's developing.
But the David Kennedy model is actually to bring the community in and bring the guys, I think it's the one on your right, is to bring the guys who are the most active criminals, the ones you're looking for, the ones committing most of the crimes, into a community meeting, identify them, let them know that they're there, let them know they're being watched, but bring the community in as part of it. That's where his model in some ways differs, because you're actually talking to the people that you're saying you're going to get busted or you're going to come get it
right.
Together,
right? And I'm very familiar with that part of what he advances, and in fact, it's been done here. It was done here in Baltimore several
briefly
years ago.
But Martin O'Malley, when he was
that's correct, it didn't work under the when Governor O'Malley was the mayor, and as recently I think as maybe about a year and a half ago, we tried to do it again. At least the police department tried to do it along with the U.S. Attorney's Office. So that's certainly a component. That's certainly one way to try to approach the issue. But I think that on balance, and not to I'm trying not to quibble with you, but on balance, yeah. I think that what David Kennedy and Jeremy Travis, who's the president of John Jay College of criminal justice up in New York, and they're very close. And I know Mr. Travis, he and I have worked together to try to develop these programs. I think they would say that we're definitely on the right track, at least consistent with what they're doing.
Now, during the campaign, one of the things you complained about in the campaign with the then state's attorney, Pat Chesimy, was the police being unprepared, not making good arrests, not showing up in court. And that's one of the ways that you kind of attacked her record and led you to the victory. In that race, how has it changed that dramatically? I mean, we're looking now at, we're seeing, like at least the closed cases and murders are just as dismal as they were when she was in charge.
Well, we've done a lot, frankly, on that point. I'm glad you brought it up. First of all, one of the issues that we found when we arrived was our FTA, or failure to appear, rate was pretty high for the police department. Well, we've already had a dramatic impact on that. FTAs for police officers is down dramatically, both in the district court level as well as the circuit court level. And I can tell you that when I first became state's attorney and met with the police commissioner That was top on his list of agenda items that he wanted to try to attack. So we worked hard. So that gets the officers into court.
What is it, what are the numbers? What do you mean?
I don't have them in front of me. I can't tell you. I mean, it's much as 25 or 30%, I think, at the circuit court level, but I'm not positive. I just don't have the numbers in front of me. But I do know that they're a lot lower because we look at that. We track that stuff. So that's number one. Number two, we are developing better systems, working with the police department, to make sure that they get the proper notice to come to court. Because what we found when we examined this issue, that a number of officers just weren't getting the notice on time, or they had vacation scheduled or other reasons not to be in the office, even though they were set for trial on a particular day. This is really a system issue, a process issue, but it's something that we've been really, almost since we arrived, been trying to develop, working with the police department to come up with a much better system to get the notice. And finally, one of the things that we've implemented is what we call a vertical prosecution model. So what that means is this, that prior to me becoming the state's attorney, the way in which the office operated is that a defendant is arrested on a particular charge, it gets reviewed at central booking and that by assistant state's attorney, then it's reviewed by a felony screener at the district court level. If the determination is made to charge a felony, then it comes to circuit court. And then a supervisor or a team captain in that unit looks at it. And it gets kind of passed along, maybe four or five, six prosecutors, before it gets to the actual prosecutor who's going to try the case. I don't think that's very efficient or effective. I don't think it makes for very good prosecutions. So we've implemented a vertical prosecution model. What that means is that when a defendant now is arrested and charged with a case, it is assigned to a prosecutor at that moment, and that prosecutor keeps the case all the way through to the end. Now, what that does is two things. First, it lets the prosecutor get involved from the beginning and make determinations about what type of investigation needs to be done, right, to get ready for trial rather than just have the case handed to him or her. And second, it gets the prosecutor much more connected and involved with the law enforcement officer at the very early stages to stop the very things that you mentioned when you asked me your question.
Let's go to the phones first. 410-319-8888. You have been asking for Greg Bernstein to be on the show. He's here. 410-319-8888. And we'll go to these calls now. Clarence in Baltimore, you're on the air. Hi, Clarence, you're on the air. Clarence, not there? Okay, well, we'll get to the next call. 410-319. Here comes somebody to save the calls. 410-319-8888. His number here will come back to Greg Bernstein. Come back to your calls as soon as we get the high sign across the glass. So one of the things that I'm doing, dying to ask you ever since our show last week.
Who was on your show last week?
We just had a number of criminal justice issues came up last week.
Oh, I see.
And the Maryland Court of Appeals has now said that indigent people have a right to a lawyer. Everyone has a right to a lawyer in front of a bail commissioner rather than just being through the commissioner and put in jail. So, A, I'm curious, how do you agree with that ruling? How is your office going to respond to the ruling? How do you think that's going to change the nature of the work inside inside the court system?
Right. Okay. So to answer the first part of your question, the Court of Appeals decision indicating or ruling that defendants arrested on charges have a right to counsel at the initial bail determination stage, which at present is made by the court commissioners, is based on the statute that created the public defender system.
The Gideon case.
No, actually that's not correct. There's a Maryland statute that specifies – oh, I see what you're saying. No, you may – well, I understand the way you use the Gideon case, so maybe you're right in that regard. But there's a statute that the Maryland legislature passed creating the public defender system.
Right.
Within that statute, it sets forth as a statutory matter – What the stages of the proceeding in which a defendant has the right to representation by the public defender. And that is the basis of the court's ruling. The court specifically said that it was not making any kind of constitutional determination as to whether you had a Sixth Amendment right to counsel as a constitutional matter, as a Sixth Amendment matter. They said simply that the wording of the statute is such that this is your right. So, for example, if the legislature changes the statute, that'd be the end of the issue, unless they then address the constitutional question.
But it'll change the way things are done. I mean, because within 30 days of that ruling, it's going to be the case. Public defenders or somebody's got to find a way to man lawyers at the bail hearings to ensure that defendants have a right to a lawyer at their initial hearing. It'll probably change some procedures in your office if that takes place as well.
Well, you said a couple things. First, you asked a couple questions. First of all, you are correct that when the mandate issues in 30 days or 30 days from the opinion, which I guess was last week,
right,
that there will now be an obligation on the public defender to provide that kind of representation. But it's, again, important to remember that that is on statutory grounds, not constitutional grounds. So as long as the statute remains in effect, as long as the legislature does not amend the statute, for example.
But do you think it's an important ruling? Do you think it is important for somebody to have a lawyer at their bail hearing?
Well, it's my responsibility to, as the state's attorney, to make recommendations where we think is appropriate for bail. I think it's important for your listeners to know that there's only a small percentage of cases in which we in the state's attorney's office actually make those recommendations.
No, right. But what I'm suggesting, though, is as a lawyer, as a leading legal officer in the city of Baltimore, do you think the ruling was important that people have a right to a lawyer at a bail hearing?
I certainly think it's a very important ruling. I think that the court's opinion, at least consistent with what the statute said, is the right one, that that the statute does provide for that level of representation. But to answer your question about to what extent, to what degree do we have to prepare or change our operations, I think Baltimore City is a little unique in that we have at central booking where all defendants are taken who are arrested. That's where they appear when they appear before the commissioners. We man that 24/7 already. We have state's attorneys that are there reviewing the charging documents of every case, making determinations about whether the defendant who's been arrested is one who warrants either a no bail or a high bail.
Now, you've said recently, if I recall this correctly, that you are determined that people who are arrested for certain kinds of crimes either receive no bail or remain in custody. They're not going to see the streets if they're considered dangerous criminals.
That's
right,
correct.
Right,
and that's,
right?
Yeah. And so, that's the point I was trying to make before that. Oh, I'm sorry. You want to finish?
Yeah, so the question.
That was the premise to your
that
question.
That was the premise of the question.
All right, good. All right. Now you've done the premise. Now the question.
Here's the question. So the question is, do you then—
I better start taking notes here.
On the flip side of that, I mean, would you then also recommend that people be released on their own recognizance if they're nonviolent offenders, if they're like busted for driving without a license, small amounts of marijuana, anything that's not a nonviolent crime that doesn't pose a danger to the society at large? Would you then also recommend on the other side that they be released on their own recognizance rather than filling jails up with people full of nonviolent offenders?
Right. Well, look, I think it's two things. I think number one, it's important to understand, or for your listeners to understand, what is the criteria for determining conditions of release? And it's really a two-part question. Is the defendant either a danger to the community, or is he or she a risk of flight? That's the criteria that the judicial officer has to look at to determine whether some form of conditions of release, be it supervision by pretrial services, be it a bail or whatever. So within that context, though, this is the point I was trying to make before that, we're doing 50,000 cases a year maybe that comes through central booking. I mean, it's a huge number. And we are not making recommendations in the large majority of those cases because we've already made a determination that the case is one that doesn't warrant, in our view, the kind of restrictive bails or no bail because the person is a violent offender. The large balance of the cases go to the commissioners and they make their own determination as to what's appropriate. We're not really there making the recommendation. Now, if the system changes so that the public defender is now present in each of those proceedings and we have to reevaluate, well, then we'll study it and we'll make a determination.
Let's go to the phones at 410-319-8888. Let's try this one more time. And Clarence, you're on the air.
Can you hear me, Mr. Clarence?
We can, Clarence. Thanks for holding.
Yes, sir. Thank you. As far as this is not the reason I called, but I just want to throw this comment in there. As far as the numbers game with the murders in the city, common sense would tell anybody that there's nothing you can do about the number of murders that happen in a given city unless you do something to change the social conditions So it would be more honest to say, like, we don't know what this, whether the number is going to go up or whether the number is going to go down, because nothing has changed to change these conditions that cause people to commit these kind of acts. But the real reason, question I wanted to ask was this. Where does the line begin where not only does the state's attorney's office prosecute criminal acts, but protect the individual citizens from crimes committed against them by the police department? A case in point is you have a 58-year-old man who's in a grocery store moving lottery cameras and rearranging security cameras when all of the known local drug dealers are just standing around in the store, and the police come in and drag this man out and throw him on the ground and search him for just because they happen to think that he might have been a drug dealer or engaged in something. They didn't know why he was there. Now, to me, he has no recourse from an act like that. They came in not knowing who they wanted, just picked the oldest guy in the room out and drug him out while the drug dealer stood around and basically laughed at it. So where does your office come in protecting the individual citizen against that kind of act? And that person was me.
Okay, so Clarence, thanks for your call. Let me try to respond. First, as to your first point regarding the homicide rate and the social conditions, I could not agree with you more. I mean, I think that, yes, there's been a dramatic reduction in the number of homicides in Baltimore City in the last 30 years, and I'm sure you've read all the press about how for 2011, it's the lowest rate, I think, in 38 years. Of course, one is too many, but it's certainly a huge measure of the effectiveness of the current police strategies and the strategies in the state's attorney's office. But I think you quite correctly point out that only gets you so far, and that until we develop the kind of social opportunities, I guess is the best way to put it, in forms of educational opportunities, employment, housing, and the like, we're not going to create an environment in which people will stop killing each other. And then the fact of the matter is that in our city, we have neighborhoods that are extremely depressed, that are hotbeds for criminal activity, and that's where these homicides occur. And we can hold ground, we can reduce the homicide rate, and I think that the police commissioner is doing an incredible job in accomplishing that, and we're trying to do our part as well. But you're quite right that that's only half the game. Maybe not even half the game. I think the mayor recognizes that. I think that's why the mayor wants more people to move into the city. I think that's why the mayor is trying to develop strategies to provide the kind of educational and housing and social and employment opportunities we've talked about. Now, as to your more specific question, the citizens, we do have an obligation to the citizens who are the victims of criminal activity or assaults, as you've described it, by the police department. That's why when I became state's attorney, I completely revamped what was known as our police misconduct unit. It's now our police integrity unit. We've recruited a very experienced, talented criminal defense lawyer, private practice, to come in and run that unit. What we have done since she came in the last 8 or 9 months is, number one, set up a system to track when there are allegations made against police officers, because we have an ethical and professional obligation that when charges are brought against police officers, that we have to disclose that information in cases in which they testify. And before I arrived as state's attorney, there was no real coherent system in place to do that. Now we do, so I feel pretty confident we're meeting our obligations. And secondly, we need to diligently and thoroughly and where necessary aggressively investigate and prosecute those types of allegations, and we're not afraid to prosecute where we think is appropriate. So I recognize the issue that you raised, and I'm committed that where there is police misconduct, because look, you know, the police department is no different than any other agency, and when you have people that are committing, you know, violations of the law, they need to be investigated and prosecuted.
Let's go back to the phones of 410-319-8888 here with Greg Bernstein, of course, Baltimore City State's Attorney, and we'll go to Darren. You're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Bernstein, and the gentleman that allowed me that accepted my call.
Darren, welcome.
My question is, what can the state's attorney do about employers who don't hire people because they say they may have a criminal record that's supposed to be discarded or expunged? Employers are still looking at your past and determining that you're not eligible to work for them because of your past criminal record. It may not be Bernstein's fault, but what can he do about employers not ignoring that black box?
You know, Darren, you bring up a great, great point, and one that I talk about a lot when I talk to groups of people, because you know, one of the things that people just, it seems to me, do not want to, not that they don't want to address, but they seem too focused on not too focused, but they're focused on this idea that public safety is important, which I feel strongly that it is, which is why I, you know, took on this office. But what people neglect is, what about ex-offenders? What about the people that are cycling back into the community once they successfully complete their probation or if they have to go to jail? You know, a conviction is in this day and age is a huge scarlet letter on people, and it severely restricts their ability for employment opportunities, for educational opportunities. It's something that I am very sensitive to, and I think that in one sense or one avenue is you've got to go to the legislature, you've got to go to your elected officials and try to get them to pass legislation that protects them. Ex-offenders in a way that their criminal record does not act as a barrier to these types of things. We also have to have government involvement to provide programs for ex-offenders to get them job training and facilities that allow them to become productive members of society. And lastly, where I come in as state's attorney is we are very sensitive to the notion that I described before, that people with criminal records have difficult opportunities or abilities to get education and jobs and the like. So where we can avoid conviction and incarceration through a number of our problem-solving courts, I'm talking about people who are arrested for nonviolent offenses, because if it's something that involves violence and public safety, that's where I draw the line. But the extent to which we can provide alternatives for people who are arrested for offenses that do not impose a danger to society, we need to think of alternatives. And we have that with our early resolution court, our mental health court, our prostitution diversion program, things of that nature. And that keeps people from getting a criminal record and so that they don't run into the problems that you've described.
We're here with Greg Bernstein, our state's attorney here in Baltimore City. 410-319-8888 is the number. We have to take a very brief break. We'll come back. Hank, you're the next caller up, and whoever those other callers are behind Hank, hold on. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Greg Bernstein, our Baltimore City State's Attorney, is our guest this hour at 410-319-8888. And Hank, in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Good morning, Dave, Mr. Steiner.
Hi, Hank.
How you feeling today, Mr. Bernstein?
I'm well, Hank. How are you, sir?
I'm really one of your greatest fans. I will admit that, right? This is what I want to know. One, since you've been in office, right, can you honestly and truthfully say that you've recommended the same amount of allotted time for Caucasian offender as you would for a minority defendant? Two, what are you planning on, what can you do to offer somebody a better chance before, once you offer them that time, what is it you're willing to do to keep them from coming back to you, to create the revolving door which absolutely keeps you in power, right? Or not necessarily you per se, but keeps the status quo in power. And three, it's ironic that, you know, after you and the mayor all of a sudden get elected, we lose like 100-some murders, right? I just want to know, and this is just me being cynical, are some of these murders not actually being recorded as they were back in the day in the 80s? That's what I would like to know. Those three questions.
Okay, Hank. Thanks. Thanks for your call. I appreciate your candor. And let me try to address each one. I think as to your first question, I do take issue with the notion that we are making recommendations for sentence based upon race. I mean, it's just simply not true. None of my prosecutors do that. They've not been given any instruction to do that. And I think it's important, Hank, to realize, as well as the listeners, that, of course, I don't see every case that comes across the desk. I mean, we've got some 50,000, 60,000 cases a year, and I have to rely on my assistant state's attorneys to make what they believe to be the appropriate recommendations. And I will tell you, in that regard, One of the things we've also done in our first year is put together specific charging guidelines and plea bargaining guidelines for the prosecutors in my office to follow. And that way, I think that we're very transparent and uniform, and the public can see exactly why we're making the determinations that we made, so that now, for the first time, my prosecutors have specific written guidelines that will guide them in deciding what charges to proceed against and what kind of sentences to recommend. As to your second question, look, Hank, this is why I ran for office and tried to become the state's attorney. I agree with you about this revolving door problem. I think that it's very important that we focus our resources in a very strategic way on these repeat violent offenders because, as I mentioned in the early part of the show, a disproportionate amount of the violent crime in this city is committed by a relatively small number of people. So I think that if we, using our new major investigations unit that I mentioned before, if we focus using that division, that unit, on focusing on these people, I think we can stop this revolving door. Lastly, on the murder rate and the murders not being recorded, you know, I tell you, Hank, I'd like to be able to say that this incredibly rapid, I'm not rapid, but this incredible drop in the homicide rate happened in the last year, but it didn't. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, the homicide rate has been moving down pretty steadily since 2007. So it's not as if all of a sudden I got elected or Mayor Rawlings Blake got elected and you saw this huge drop. This is something that's moving steadily. I mean, if you want to tie it to one particular individual, I mean, you have to look at the police commissioner who, Fred Bielfeld, who adopted new strategies to try to combat the violent crime in the city. But it's not something that just happened overnight.
Now, but the amazingly enough, I mean, Baltimore City's rate is down below 200, which is wonderful for the city. On the other hand, per 100,000 is still near the top in America in terms of murders in a major city. And our closing rate in the police department is down to 46%. As of the end of the year, it was 47% in 2008. It's 46% now, and so there's still a lot of issues to deal with on that level. I mean, and that's one of the things that people complained again. Pat Jessamy complained about that they weren't closing cases, didn't bring good cases to them to be able to prosecute. But now we're not even closing the cases.
Is that a question or a comment?
It's a little bit of both. A little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Well, look. Here's what I would say about that. Certainly the clearance rate, I think anybody in the police department would tell you, is not where it ought to be. And that's something that the commissioner has to work on and the people in the homicide division. But we're working with the police department to try to improve that rate. And you're not going to hear me, quote unquote, blaming people, which is the word you describe, which is what my predecessor did when she was the state's attorney. And I think that it's that kind of attitude that does not foster progress and working together. So what we're doing, as I've described before, is through our vertical prosecution model, for example, we've been doing it in the homicide division for the last few months, and I think it's really going to have an impact because now, you know, the homicide detectives will know who the state's attorney is that's assigned to the particular case the moment that the murder occurs. And so they can work together to try to build better cases. And I don't think that you can just say that it's all the fault of the homicide division of the Baltimore Police Department that their clearance rate is low. I think that the state's attorney's office has to step up as well and help the police department in ways that we can to improve their investigative techniques. We're working with them on the training front, and they have in-service training, and they have kind of continuing educational programs too, and we're helping them in that regard.
But what's interesting to me is I was looking at the stats around the country, you know. Closing rates are low in some cities. New Orleans, 22%. Detroit, 21%. But if you look at a place like Philadelphia, there's 75% of the closing rate, 92% in Denver, 94% in San Diego. Some cities are doing something right, and some cities are doing something wrong. It seems to me because Philly is not that different than Baltimore. It's a larger city, as a matter of fact.
True.
And they're doing a great deal better closing those cases than we are.
Their clearance rate is higher. Well, you know, again, Mark, I think that this is a question that's better addressed to the police department than me. I mean, my office is not the one that, you know, conducts the initial investigation. I mean, but what we can do to help the police department is work with them on the front end to try to build these better cases.
Let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Tisa, you're on the air in Bowie.
Hello, Mr. Steiner, Mr. Bernstein. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Welcome.
I actually called in a couple of weeks ago about the murder case.
Oh, yes. I have it on my list here to bring up, but since you called, you can bring it up. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. I know, Mr. Bernstein, every case does not reach your desk, but this case is one that the circumstances of it just seem to be extreme and pretty questionable. The suspect in this case, we all know suspects are innocent until proven guilty, but this is a first-degree murder charge, and the suspect has been released on bail twice. And a lot of people have attached some racial implications to this, and this is not what I want to do. What I'd like to comment on is that when a person is let go for a crime that's serious, it sends a message to people that the value of life must not be that high, and that's something that I think the city of Baltimore and, frankly, no city in this country can afford to begin setting as a trend. And my question to you is that since I have you on the phone right now, is there anything that the family could do or that anyone involved in this case could do to go back and review that? Because on a first-degree murder charge, this is rare, and it frankly just doesn't seem fair.
Well, Tisa,
I
know exactly what she's talking about. Tisa, working backwards, no, there's really nothing at this point that the family or we can do to go back. Second, I couldn't agree with you more with everything that you said about the kind of message that it shows. And lastly, what I would say about that case is we recommended no bail. I mean, that was our recommendation. We did not think that bail was appropriate. We don't think bail is ever appropriate in a case involving murder, and we made that recommendation. But the judge felt differently, and that's the way our system works. The prosecutor make our recommendation. The defense lawyer makes his or her recommendation on behalf of his or her client. The judge weighs the factors and makes the determination. But I don't want anybody to think that there was any kind of double standard because we were not looking for the kind of bail that this defendant got.
And to that, the perception, what Tisa's talking about here, the perception of race and racism that people sometimes throw at you and your office and other parts of the city, or just because things like, I know you recommended no bail, but things like Brandon Kyle Mitchell getting off twice, $50,000 bail, and a young black man's murdered, or people look at what happened. Two totally different things. But we didn't get you on the air during that period of time. But when the whole Shlomo Rim case came over, those kind of issues and the lack of sometimes the lack of the public image of your office kind of explaining things to the public raises a lot of hackles.
Well, I'll say a couple things about that. First, as I said before, we recommended no bail. So,
right,
so any perception that there being a double standard just doesn't exist in that particular case. And second, I walk a very fine line as the state's attorney. I have both an ethical and a professional responsibility not to comment publicly about ongoing matters. It's part of the model rules of professional conduct. And as state's attorney, that rule applies to me with even greater force because as state's attorney in my position, anything I might say publicly about a case is going to have greater weight, a greater imprimatur, so to speak, that people will apply. So as the state's attorney, I need to be very conscious of that and not say or do anything that might prejudice the case, prejudice the defendant who's entitled to a fair trial by an impartial jury. So I don't want to say anything publicly about ongoing cases that might influence that decision-making. However, and this is when I talk about walking the fine line, I am an elected official. And as an elected official, I have a responsibility to the public to explain myself and explain the decisions that I make so that I can be judged based on that. That's how our system operates, and I accept that. So what I say often when it comes to matters that are ongoing cases is that I can only say so much, and I ask people to wait for the case to complete and for all the evidence to come in, and then you can make your judgments about whether you think we made the right decisions or the wrong decisions.
410-319-8888 is the number here. We are here with Greg Bernstein, Baltimore City State's Attorney, 410-319-8888, and let's go to Mr. John and then Russ and then Jackie. Mr. John, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
My question is, a person is charged with a handgun violation and goes to court and it is null processed. could you explain null process as one? And the other is that if a person is arrested for a marijuana violation and is placed on probation, would either of the two or both of them be a mark on his record that may hamper him in getting a employment later on?
Okay, John, let me try to answer both questions for you. First, when a case is nal prost, which is Latin for nal prosecute, which means an election not to prosecute the case, it can apply to any case, not just a firearms case. It can apply to any case. So that's a decision that the state's attorney makes, and the rules provide that he or she can exercise that decision not to proceed with the case, not to prosecute the case. And there's, of course, a host of reasons why that decision might be made. It might be part of plea negotiations. It may be because of what the victim wants to see happen. It may be because of evidentiary issues, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there is a procedure in the law that if you receive a nal pros for a particular case, you can move to have your record expunged and all record of it will be eliminated, and so no one can go back and look at it. The same applies with the probation that you talked about, the second part of your question involving marijuana. But that's, again, not just marijuana. In any case, you can get probation. But the distinction there, John, is there's probation and then there's what's called probation before judgment, which maybe is what you're referring to, because many people receive what we call PBJ or probation before judgment for possession of small amounts of marijuana. If you receive probation before judgment, you also have the right to move, to complete a form. It's a very simple thing. Submit it, and your record can be expunged.
Greg Bernstein's here in the studio, 410-319-8.
If it was just probation and not the other PBJ, then could that be expunged also?
No, it cannot.
Okay, great. Okay. All right, so...
But let me say, John, let me interrupt you and say, because, no, this is actually an important point, because John touches on the issue that a lot of your callers have talked about with respect to ex-offenders, so to speak, and being saddled with that. And there are a number of delegates. Delegate Stukes, for example, is one who is trying to expand the list. There are a number of smaller type offenses like disorderly conduct,
right,
maybe, and loitering. I don't have them all in my fingertips, where even if you get just probation and not probation for judgment, you can get that expunged as well. And so if there's a particular offense that you'd like to see within that group, then I recommend that you talk to your legislator to see if you can get that included as an offense, that even if you get probation, it can also be expunged.
John, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Russ in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Mark, to you and State's Attorney.
Good evening, Russ.
My question to you, sir, I heard you say to a previous caller that you don't see most of the cases that come to your office, and I can well understand that. And I'm not trying to ambush you here, but my question is, what triggers you personally getting involved with a case? Because I've been laboring under the notion that you got involved with the Rudersheim case in Upper Park Heights, and that it was you who recommended made the downgrading of the charges that had originally been laid. And I'm sure that you're aware that there was a lot of controversy in that case, and a lot of people felt as though the case was undercharged because it smacked of vigilantism. When you're on a routine community watch patrol, one of the main instructions that you get is not to exit your vehicle. The minute you exit your vehicle and get involved with the situation, then you have taken on a role that you have not been trained for or not authorized to do, and it creates the kind of a problem that resulted over there. So can you talk a little bit about why you got involved with that case, if in fact you did? I'm saying that this is stuff I've read and heard.
Right.
So that's why I'm asking you personally. What was your involvement? How did you get – and what is it that's going to trigger you to get involved in cases? Because a part of your platform when you ran was that you were personally going to try a case.
Right.
So I would just like to hear you talk about that a little bit, please.
Right. Okay. So let's talk with the specific for the second. Let's talk about the Wershon case. Now – you know, as I mentioned before, I don't want to get into the facts of that case in particular because the trial date's coming up. And again, I don't want to do anything to jeopardize the trial. That case did make it to my radar, so to speak, because it happened right around the time that I took office. But what I did was I took one of our most experienced prosecutors, one of our top prosecutors who was a former prosecutor in our homicide division and is now one of our zone chiefs under our new community prosecution model. And he is handling that case. He's handled that case from the beginning. He did all the investigation. He did all the work. And working with him as well as his division chief, we made a joint decision to not to reduce the charge from first-degree assault to second-degree assault with respect to the one brother, but also we made the decision to charge the second brother because when I inherited the case, only the one brother had been charged. But we felt, based on the facts and the evidence, that it was appropriate to charge the second one as well. So there are now two defendants. So we did do that. And again, I think that once the case is completed and the evidence comes out, you can make a determination as to whether you think it was appropriate to reduce the charge from first degree to second degree assault. In terms of, you know, as a general matter, what's my quote unquote criteria, I guess, for getting involved in particular cases? I don't really have a criteria. I do monitor on a daily basis the cases that come into the office. I'm aware on a daily basis when each of my prosecutors are in trial and what kind of case they're in trial for. And often what happens, is this Russ or?
Russ.
Often what happens is that people bring cases to me in my position. In other words, my division chiefs or my deputy state's attorneys, if they feel that a case has a particular thorny issue or an issue that may need my advice and consultation, they tend to bring them to me. I don't, as opposed to the other way around, and that's how I tend to get involved in most of the cases that I do.
Russ, thanks for your call, as usual. 410-319-8888, and Jackie in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you, and good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening, Jackie.
The former caller sort of took a little bit of what I had in mind. Mr. Bernstein, you, during your campaign, you made sort of a big deal out of the fact that the former state attorney, you said, you know, was not in the courtroom a lot. And you said that you would be in that courtroom. And so I was wondering, how many cases have you tried since you've been in office, as opposed to how many she tried? I don't know. But you're the one that made the big deal out of that, out of the fact that she was in the courtroom and that you definitely would be in the courtroom. And the other side of what I was thinking about was when I heard you talk earlier in the week or last week about, the new community
prosecution model.
That model. I had a concern, and I guess as any citizen would, regarding the close working, hand in hand, as I heard you say, the prosecutors would be working with the districts. And my concern is really it covers integrity. At this point in our time, in our community, unfortunately, there's not a great big, a lot of trust in the police, between the police and the citizens. And so, you know, what ensures that, you know, the evidence that's collected by the police against someone who is alleged to have committed a crime, that, you know, that your state's attorney is going to make sure that that is good evidence and it's not bogus. And, you know, when it comes to your office or wherever else it goes, that it's,
okay,
you know, something that you're going to say, well, that's not even worth the time of day.
Right. Okay. Right. Okay, Jackie. So let me try to respond to your questions. You're absolutely right. I did make it a major part of my campaign platform that I would be in the courtroom trying cases, unlike my predecessor. To answer your question, my predecessor had not tried a single case in her position in the 15 years that she was state's attorney. She never went into the courtroom, never tried a case, not one in the 15 years. So in my first year, I've already tried one case, and interestingly enough, I prosecuted three Baltimore City police officers for kidnapping, assault, and misconduct in office. So to the extent that you worry about our ability to maintain our distance and our independence, I think the fact that, we went in and tried that case and I was personally involved in it should give you an indication of how I feel about that issue. On the subject of working closely with the police and the community prosecution model, Jackie, the fact of the matter is it's hard enough to fight crime as it is. I mean, this is a very, very difficult task. But if you do not have a good working relationship with the police department, who are responsible for the initial investigation, working with us and trying to put the cases together, you're just not going to be successful. So we have to make that our default, so to speak. You have to assume that we're going to try to forge those kinds of relationships, and that's how we become effective and do a better job. Now, as I said in the beginning of Mark's show, that is not to say that there's not going to be instances in which police officers violate the law and maybe commit a crime. And that's why we've revamped our police misconduct unit. That's why we have a new police integrity unit. That's why I recruited somebody from the outside to investigate those cases and, where appropriate, prosecute them.
Answer the question before I go back to the phones. We only have a few minutes left, but this is a very quick question. Do you, given all the latest research on the growth of juvenile brains and people's brains, do you believe still that youth, kids who are charged with a serious crime, should be charged as adults?
I think that when juveniles commit serious offenses that involve violence and affect public safety in the way that impacts on the community, and their record is such that there is a potential for them to commit further violent acts, then yes, we need to charge them as adults.
And why is that? I mean,
given the reasons I just stated.
But given all the research on how brains develop and how people change, and the research on young people who've given life and how they change while they're in prison, is there a way that we should rethink how we prosecute?
Well, look.
Not that they should be sent away, but we think how we prosecute.
Well, you know, Mark, look, I'll tell you this. I mean, I recently went to Yale Law School and participated in a symposium, you know, on this very issue, and I was with a lot of very, very smart people that deal with juvenile crime. That's what they deal with. And they were uniform in their belief that when it comes to juveniles who commit violent crime, that it is appropriate, given the criteria and the circumstances I described, that they be prosecuted in that fashion. I mean, where you're reading all the research and the new programs and the like involving juvenile justice deals with the vast majority of other cases involving juveniles that do not involve violence, and that's where we need to think about alternatives.
I guess we have time for no more callers, is that right? And they're saying no. So, folks, we'll get Mr. Bernstein to join us here one more time in the next few months and keep our conversations alive here in the community. Greg Bernstein, Baltimore City State's Attorney, thank you so much for being a guest on the show tonight.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
And, folks, we'll be right back. When we come back, we're going to have a different kind of conversation and take a trip across the globe with folks in Uganda. And stay with us for that.